right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of the show, I'll be talking with Cade Crockford. Cade is the director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Technology for Liberty Project about how face recognition surveillance technology is racist. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking with Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-initiator and editorial board member of RefuseFascism.org on George Floyd, Trump, the history of Juneteenth, and Tulsa, Oklahoma, and why people need to be in the streets. Now, you'll notice that Carl and I are talking about protests the weekend of Juneteenth, which has already passed. But the need to be in the streets is still just as urgent. And of course, Carl Dix's comments on Juneteenth, the Tulsa massacre, and the murder of George Floyd are extremely timely. All right. Stop police terror against black and brown people. No to Trump's massive insult to black people. Trump, Pence out now. Into the streets, June 19th and 20th. Yeah, that's something to get yourself on fire. Listen to all that. And joining us to talk about this is someone who's a regular guest on the show. Well, regularly a regular guest, but he's been a little absent for a while. And I wanted to make sure that we change that. His name is Carl Dix. And Carl's here to talk with us today about just the kind of, you know, basically, you know, Carl, here's the thing. I think actually what you're here to talk with us today is about the sentence that I read coming into it, you know, where there's a lot of stuff going on in the world right now. There's a lot of stuff going on in terms of what's happening to black people and what's happening to the society at large. And a lot of what you've spoken to, and you've spent like, what, the last month or so really deep into what's happening in terms of what's happening to black people around the country, what's happening to other people around the country, immigrants. And it's been very important that you've been able to come and, one, be in there, but also that what you've found has been able to come out and be given to people so that they can learn about this and help to jump in and change things. So first, I want to welcome you to the show. All right?
Okay. Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. Let's talk about this to begin with, just to kind of frame some things regarding these weekend events that you've been out building for. We're at a crossroads, and there's an urgent need for people to recognize that and act accordingly. You know, I think there's a lot of people who have a lot of ideas about what the crossroads could be, but I wanted to talk to you about what it is. So let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, this is an important reality that people have to get, because on the one hand, there have been beautiful and powerful upsurges in the wake of the police murder of George Floyd, and murders that have happened since then and around that time, and concentrating just centuries of the boot that this capitalist imperialist system has had on the necks of black people for more than 400 years. People have stood up. They have said no more of this. They want to see it stop. They want to see the white supremacy out of which these horrors emerged, ended once and for all. And it has not just been black people. It's been large numbers of white people. I was up in Minneapolis for a week after the murder of George Floyd, and there were indigenous peoples groups, you know, the Native Lives Matter group that was out in the streets calling for justice for George Floyd and an end to white supremacy. So this has been beautiful and it's been powerful. And a lot of people have been inspired by it and move to join and stand in solidarity with it, not only in this country, but around the world. Same time, some people have been terrified by it. Chief among them, that bloated bag of fascist feces that occupies the White House right now. And he has called for these protests to be crushed. He has egged on mayors and governors to set curfews, call out the National Guard, unleash the tear gas, rubber bullets, and all the rest. And he has threatened that if they don't do that, he will call out the military to flood the streets to crush these protests. And what is a gauntlet that's been thrown down by the fascists who hold the reins of power in this country, that they will refuse to tolerate any more of this. Trump calls it law and order, but it is the order of fascism, and it is the law of not justice and equality for anybody, but suppressing anybody who stands up in opposition. And right now we're at a point where either these fascists will go forward with their threats, and they already called out motley assembly of federal law enforcement agents to help clear the streets in D.C. when Trump wanted to do his photo op at the church across the park from the White House. So it's not an idle threat. We cannot back down at this point. We cannot either fall into, well, they've charged these cops, they've charged some other cops like the one that shot Brother Brooks in the back in Atlanta. So now let's see if the system works, because if we do that, it will work the way that it has always worked, and that is giving a pass to brutal murdering cops. Nor can we go off into, well, we're going to reimagine policing and we're going to defund the police and dismantle the police, because we're living in a capitalist imperialist society and system that needs police, and not only needs police, but it needs brutal frontline enforcers for the relations of inequality, degradation, and poverty that so many millions of people are forced in. That's why the police are out there. That's why they do what they do. It's not them failing to do their job when they brutalize people. They're actually doing the job that they're out there for. So this is the crossroads. We either recognize it for what it is, stay in the streets, and take up the gauntlet that Trump has thrown down and throw it back in his face, or we allow the fascists to go forward, consolidate the all-around agenda of fascism that they're bringing forward, and to consolidate their hold on power, which has already been catastrophic for humanity. We can look at the response to the coronavirus pandemic and the tens of thousands of people who needlessly lost their lives because of the way this regime denied the science in relation to the pandemic and has continually refused to take steps needed to deal with it, but also the way that they're enforcing their agenda in terms of attacking and suppressing immigrants, going after the rights of LGBTQ people, and calling out their fascist base. That's another part of what they've been doing that a lot of people are not as aware of, because it's not happening in some of the major population centers across the country.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's something I want to dig into a little bit more, because, you know, Friday's the opening day of this action. There's all kinds of specific actions that are called for at that time. You know, Black Lives Matter, and, you know, what you're doing and other people are doing out there. And I want to get into that and related questions, but I thought it would be good to dig into some very connected things right now. First, these actions are occurring in the context of some very important history that we should understand, and we don't, too many of us don't understand it or even know that it exists. Let's talk about that. And for example, Juneteenth in the history of Tulsa and what that concentrates and what we should learn from that for today.
Yeah, that's a very important coming together that people need to get. Juneteenth is the day in 1865 when the Union Army reached Texas and announced that slavery had been ended. So it didn't get to enslave people in Texas until June 19th, 1865, because the Confederate Army had control of Texas till that point. And that has become a day to celebrate the official end of the enslavement of Black people here in this country. Tulsa is a very important site because it is the site of arguably one of the largest mass murders of Black people by white racist mobs, because in 1921, white mobs descended on the Greenwood section of Tulsa, which was the location of an area of Black businesses. It was a Black neighborhood. There were a number of businesses there. There were a number of prosperous Black people who lived there. It was dubbed Black Wall Street because of that. And the white mob descended on that section of town, burned down homes, murdered everybody they could find. They murdered hundreds of Black people, forced hundreds of Black people to flee their homes as they were burned. This was initiated by mobs of white people, joined and assisted by local law enforcement, by the National Guard when it was called out, and also assisted by the U.S. military, because the U.S. military flew planes over the Greenwood section and drop bombs on that black neighborhood while the racists were marauding into it and destroying homes and dispossessing people and murdering them. So that's what Tulsa represents. And Juneteenth, June 19th, represents the official end of slavery in this country. That's when it was officially announced to enslave people in Texas. And see, selecting June 19th and Tulsa as the site to restart his MAGA rallies was a double slap in the face to black people, but not only to black people, to anybody who hates the savage oppression that has been inflicted on black people since the beginning of this country. Because these MAGA rallies are like modern day Ku Klux Klan rallies, you know, modern day rallies like the gatherings of white people who were lynching black people back in the day, because many of the thousands of lynchings of black people that happened in this country in the period from about 1880 into the 1940s and 50s were mass gatherings where whites would come out in a picnic-like atmosphere to watch the torture, mutilation, and murder of whoever the black victim was for whatever reason. And sometimes there was no reason at all for these lynchings. And that's what these MAGA rallies are. Trump waxes nostalgic about the Confederacy and to its general who were fighting for the cause of slavery. Let's not allow anybody to try to cover that over. You go back and you read the statements that all of the states that seceded and formed the Confederacy made. They all made real clear that these states' right that they were concerned about was the right to enslave black people. That was crystal clear at the start of the Civil War, and it's only been attempted to be covered up later. So if you want to uphold the monuments to these generals and other officials of the Confederacy and that legacy, you are embracing the legacy of slavery. And many of the people who do it know that. Some might be, you know, deluded and ignorant of it, but many of them know what they're embracing. So to hold a MAGA rally on this day was to say, on this day, when you're celebrating the end of slavery, and in this place, I'm going to come and rally my racist, fascist base, crushing your attempt to end up against white supremacy, and try to, I'm going to unleash the forces that I want to see help beat this down, push it back. And this is something that could not be allowed to go down unopposed. Now, in the midst of the uproar against it, Trump did move it back one day. But that's like a Malcolm X. They stuck the knife in your back 9 inches, pulled it back 3 inches, and said, sorry about that. An apology not accepted or acceptable. The outrage is still there. It's still legitimate, and it must be brought forward. And that's why Refuse Fascism has called, and I'm one of the co-initiators of Refuse Fascism, and I was recently added to its editorial board. So what Refuse Fascism has called for is for people to take to the streets on June 19th to join the protests that the Movement for Black Lives has called on that day under the slogan, Defend Black People's Lives. And we're going to join with that and bring with us the demands of Refuse Fascism. No more police murder of black people, an end to white supremacy, no fascist police state clampdown, and Trump Pence out now to those protests. And then on Saturday, June 20th, Refuse Fascism has called for people to be in the streets with those same Refuse Fascism demands and spread them as far, as broadly throughout society as possible. And one of the places that we're going to take those demands, a crew from Refuse Fascism is going to Tulsa to be at the site of Trump's MAGA rally.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-initiator and editorial board member of Refuse Fascism. All right. Well, let me ask you this, man, because I really, you know, as I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about all these things that, you know, one, if you paid any attention to history as you grew up in this country, you're not going to hear a lot of what you're talking about. And you're not going to hear a lot of truth about what the character of this country is. And I was thinking about that in relation to this, the Tulsa Massacre, one of the most horrendous examples of white riots against black people. And Trump's plan now is a celebration of all that. And it's really important, I think, for people to assess things with truth and reality. Trump's dead serious about his fascist assault and his fascist rule and his mobilization of his fascist stormtroopers. And that, to me, seems like that's what we're looking at coming up right now.
Okay, so you're exactly right. This is what we're facing. His aim is to energize and unleash a base of fascist stormtroopers as part of hammering into place an all-around fascist agenda. And one thing that I mentioned earlier about mobilizing these stormtroopers in places outside of the major population centers, it turns out that as the Black Lives Matter protests spread across the country, there was a move by fascist forces to mobilize people in opposition to that, especially in smaller cities in different parts of the country, using the talk that Trump was doing about Antifa being responsible for this and causing chaos and stuff like that. So there were places in small cities in California, Oregon, Washington, Western Pennsylvania, and other places where people who came out to protest what happened to George Floyd and to, you know, uphold the slogan Black Lives Matter found themselves confronted by armed fascists. And in some cases, people were attacked by these fascists. And in Albuquerque, in fact, these armed fascists actually shot some people in a struggle with some Latino and Latina activists and indigenous activists around the question of was a statue going to come down or not. And some of the protesters, some of the people who were protesting and trying to take the statue down were actually shot by some of these fascist stormtroopers. This is what's going on, and Trump's rally has to be set in that context. And he is looking ahead, even if others aren't, to how things are going to come down over whether the fascist regime remains in power. Because, I mean, there are things in the news now about John Bolton's book revealing that Trump's rigging of the election did not begin and end with contacting the president of the Ukraine. He has contacted other foreign leaders to try to enlist them in his effort to maintain the White House. The Republican Party, which has been going in a fascist direction for decades, is stepping up its attempts to suppress the votes of black people and brown people in particular. And a call has been put out for tens of thousands of election monitors in these fascist circles, which is another attempt to try to suppress people's ability to get out and vote. And then on top of all that, you have the fact that when asked whether the elections are definitely going to happen, son-in-law Jared Kushner could not confirm that it might not be necessary to postpone the elections because of the pandemic. And then you have, will Trump leave even if he loses the election? Because he did say in 2016, he respects the results of elections that he wins, and that if he loses them, they must be rigged. So the question of mobilizing from the side of the interest of humanity and all the people in the streets who want to see these horrors stopped, that's why we want to emphasize the need to see this gauntlet and the challenge that this fascist regime poses, and to take up not just looking to see if we'll get justice around particular cases of police murder, or even stay focused just on police murder overall and white supremacy, but see the need to drive this regime out, because whatever progressive agenda you have, it cannot be advanced successfully with this regime in power. The chances of doing anything positive go way down. And look, I've been out in the streets in Washington, D.C., and some people say to me, well, look, what we're concerned about is what's happening to black people. Why should we be concerned about Trump? The police were murdering us even when Obama was in the White House. And I have to tell them, you are right. And the reason you're right is because these police are frontline enforcers for a capitalist imperialist system. That did not begin with Donald Trump, nor will it end if we succeed in driving his regime out. That is something that is built into the fabric and framework of this capitalist imperialist system. And if you want to end that horror, the destruction of the environment and all the other horrors the system causes, that's going to take an actual revolution, one that overthrows this system and brings a totally different and far better system into being afterward. And I tell people, we've got the leadership to do that in Bob Avakian, the architect of the new communism and the forger of a new pathway of human emancipation, a leader who has spoken to and solved the problem of why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution, and has put that together in a talk that's available on the website of revcom.us. It's titled Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, and who's also authored a blueprint of the new society that could be brought into being after the revolution. So that's what we need to deal with these problems once and for all. But seriously looking at making that kind of revolution, I understand, and we in the movement for an actual revolution understand, that your chances of making revolution go way, way down if a fascist regime is allowed to consolidate its hold on power. And the same is true for whatever progressive agenda people want to put forward. You want to abolish prisons? Well, first off, I can debate you and discuss that with you quite a bit, because this system requires prisons. It requires brutal murdering police to enforce its relations of inequality and misery that it's imposed on so many millions of people. So you're not going to get it to get rid of its police or get rid of its prisons. But if you want to try to do that, how far is that going to go if the Trump-Pence regime solidifies its hold on power and remains in office? We got to drive this regime out to have any chance of a positive future. And as we do that, I'm going to be getting into with you and challenging you to get serious and scientific about realizing the very righteous things that so many people want to see happen in terms of stopping these horrors, and how that's going to take an actual revolution, and that they need to get with this movement for an actual revolution and dig into the work of its leader, Bob Avakian.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much, man. It's been really enlightening and necessary and important that people actually dig into this and make themselves heard and seen. So thanks a lot, Carl.
Thank you for having me on. And I just want to repeat, people who want to find out what Refuse Fascism is going to be doing this weekend and what it's going to be doing going forward, should go to the website refusefascism.org. And people who want to find out more about this movement for an actual revolution and its leader, Bob Avakian, need to go to the website revcom.us.
All right, Carl, thank you again, man. Really enjoyed talking with you, and look forward to talking with you again soon, man.
Okay.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-initiator and editorial board member of Refuse Fascism. We're going to take a musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
clip, reload and pull the trigger back down. 17, 18, 19, frightening when you hit it right at that sound. 26, 27, every 28 hours, put another body under that ground. Where the governor, he absent, with the prosecutor and the captain. They say the process is democratic, but we getting bullets even though we got the ballot. Where's Malcolm, where's Chewie? Where's Pac, where's Big, where's Tukey? Where's Jay, where's Nas, where's Snoopy? Yelling, the police like Boosie. Blame Nixon.
That was just Siri X with Don't Let Them Get Away With Murder. Before we hear the interview with Cade Crockford, I want to play a short clip from Bob Avakian, leader of the revolution, author, and architect of the new communism. This was posted as a response to cops calling in sick in Atlanta because one of their fellow pigs got charged with the murder of Rayshard Brooks. And this is from Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian.
Listen to the police and what they tell you. Well, if officer, notice how respectfully he's treated, Officer Wilson. He's a thug, a murderer, Officer Wilson. Well, if Officer Wilson is indicted, that's going to make it very difficult for police officers in these difficult situations where their life is on the line. What? Let's translate that into real terms. What they're saying is, if we can't go out and shoot down these youth in cold blood over and over again, we cannot and will not do our job. Because that is their job. And let me ask you this. If that is not their job, then why do they do it over and over and over and over again? And why are they never punished for doing it over and over and over again? Because this is what this system needs them to do. Because it has a whole section of people in the inner cities that it can't even profitably exploit anymore. So it treats them as so much human garbage. Instead of being able to and moving to provide them with work and a decent life, it pens them in the ghettos, encourages them to kill each other, and then kills them on top of all that.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and architect of the new communism. Now let's listen to an interview I did earlier this week with Cade Crockford, director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Technology for Liberty Project, about how face recognition surveillance technology is racist. Last week, IBM, Amazon, and Microsoft announced that they would pause or end sales of their face recognition technology to police in the United States. The announcement caught many by surprise. For years, racial justice and civil rights advocates have been warning that this technology in law enforcement hands would be the end of privacy as we know it. It would supercharge police abuses, and it would be used to harm and target Black and brown communities in particular. My guest today is someone who has spent quite a bit of time and effort exposing this. Her name is Cade Crockford, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to the show. Cade, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. You know, and I realized right after I started talking to you a little while ago, I realized that we had actually discussed some similar things about 6 months ago. And here we are again. And here we are again with the things have only gotten worse. Okay, so that's something to really keep in mind. But anyway, I wanted to jump into this and get as much as we can around this because it's such an important subject for people to be dealing with today. And you know, recently, I think in something that you wrote, you said that recently IBM, Amazon, and Microsoft, they said that they would pause or end sales of their facial recognition to police in the United States. This came as a shock to many people since they apparently had little knowledge of it happening in the first place. In fact, you write that this would, in fact, bring on serious consequences to what they were doing. So let's dig into this. What are the serious consequences you said that this would bring on or could bring on?
Well, it's a welcome move. The ACLU and nearly 100 community religious civil rights organizations a couple years ago started calling on major tech companies, including Amazon and Microsoft, to stop selling their face surveillance technology to government agencies. And for about 2 years, they ignored those requests. They did not agree to our demands. Unfortunately, it took the killing of George Floyd and too many other Black Americans by police and protests and riots across this country for those companies to wake up and realize that their sales of this technology to U.S. police departments were unacceptable from a human and civil rights perspective. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Amazon, during the height of the protests, tweeted something on its business account about how Black Lives Matter, and the ACLU replied, well, cool tweet, but are you going to stop selling your technology to police departments to supercharge racial profiling and police harassment of Black people? And we got the answer about a week and a half later when the company finally agreed to at least pause for a year its sales of its recognition product, its face surveillance technology, to U.S. police departments. So, I mean, we're pleased. You know, we're especially pleased to see that IBM has not only committed not to sell its technology to U.S. police departments, but has actually announced that it is going to stop all research and development and sales of face recognition products generally. I think that that is an acknowledgement, an admission of the fact that this technology poses a profound threat to human and civil rights, not just here in the United States, but all around the world. So we applaud that step that IBM took. Shortly following that, Amazon made an announcement that it's going to pause its sales to police departments for a year. And then shortly after that, Microsoft announced that it too would stop selling to police departments in the United States, its facial recognition technology specifically, until there is a federal law governing how law enforcement can use those technologies. And I just want to be clear about that. It's a welcome step from Microsoft, but we remain concerned because we have seen what Microsoft thinks appropriate face surveillance regulation looks like. The company was heavily involved in lobbying in support of a very dangerous bill that unfortunately became law in Washington State, where Microsoft is based and has a lot of political influence. And that law broadly authorizes police use of this technology, even to conduct mass surveillance on the streets. So we're a little bit worried when we hear Microsoft say that it will resume sales to U.S. police departments after Congress passes a federal law, because Microsoft and the ACLU do not see eye to eye on what those regulations ought to look like, and that's putting it mildly. So we are going to be paying very close attention to how these companies are engaged in lobbying in D.C. and in state capitals to ensure that a law like what was passed in Washington State does not become federal law.
Mm-hmm. You know, now one of the things that I think that you wrote in a recent article, which I thought was really important, because, you know, in addition to everything you're saying and the stuff that you're saying that's actually relatively new, but this whole question that you pose in these articles about why do big companies selling the facial recognition, why do they, you know, to cops, what does it, how can they then turn around and say, well, you know, we are, they don't really take into account this whole question of the movement of Black Lives Matter. And this is, because it's a very big question. I think you pose it very well in your piece. And I thought it was important that people wrestle with that, because it's not just this question of like, well, we won't sell this and we won't sell that. But there's actually a big question of a movement that's growing and across the country and actually around the world in a certain sense. And this whole thing about Black Lives Matter. And how do they view this? Because I get concerned about, you know, the fact that there are still so many. I mean, you just look at the recent, you know, gunning down and the stuff that's happening, you know, in the Midwest right now in Tulsa, and, you know, what they're beginning to talk about there in terms of these Nazis coming up and working with Trump to, you know, and they're armed to the teeth, you know. So I'm always sitting there and thinking, okay, what do we do in the face of this, and where is this coming from?
Yeah, I mean, face surveillance technology, as I wrote in this blog post for the ACLU, is a dangerous technology for all of us and poses very serious threats to our core civil rights and civil liberties, not least among them our First Amendment rights, our rights to protest the government without being spied on, our right to worship our religion without the government keeping track of who's going to the mosque how often, our right to associate in public without the government keeping records of who we're walking around with or whose houses we're visiting. And that applies to every single person in this country. But like many things, the impact of face surveillance in the United States is not born equally among us. And we need to be really clear about that. And the piece that I wrote lays out why face surveillance is specifically an anti-Black technology. And that's for three core reasons. The first is that the technology can have inherent racial bias in the algorithms that animate it. Some really important path-breaking research coming out of MIT, published by scholar Joy Bloomwini and Timnit Gebru, as well as Deb Raji, three Black scholars, showed years ago that many of these face surveillance algorithms have racial and gender bias built into them. So one of those studies, Gender Shades from MIT, showed that some of these technologies have error rates up to 35% for Black women, which is to say they would misclassify Black women's faces 1 in 3 times. And those very same technologies worked almost perfectly on white men. So some of these technologies have inherent racial bias built into the actual algorithm. So that's one problem. The second problem is that police departments across the country are currently using mugshot databases as the data set that they compare images against when they're trying to identify someone using facial recognition technology. And that is a problem for racial justice and for Black and Latino people specifically because of the amount of racial disparity in many arrests in this country. So cannabis arrests are just one example. Black people are 4 times more likely to be arrested for cannabis possession than white people in the United States. And obviously, politics around cannabis are changing quite a bit. A number of states, including Massachusetts, my home state, have now legalized recreational cannabis use. So a number of people, potentially millions of people, are in mugshot databases because of something as minor as a cannabis arrest, even if they live in a state that has now legalized cannabis. And so for law enforcement to use those databases as their comparison image sets for facial recognition identifications is essentially reifying historical racial bias using new technology. So a less snooty way of saying that is that Black people are being subjected to disproportionate levels of surveillance using this technology if police departments are using mugshot databases as their comparison data sets, simply because Black people have been more likely to be arrested for a variety of often low-level offenses, whether it's loitering, trespassing, disturbing the peace, or something like drug crimes. And then the third reason is that even if the algorithms themselves do not have racial bias embedded inside of them and work equally across different skin tones, even if police departments are not using mugshot databases, but instead are using something like a driver's license database as the image set that they're comparing images against for facial recognition purposes. Even if those two things are absent from the equation, we know what surveillance looks like in the United States. There is a long history dating back to slavery, frankly, of first slave patrols, then police departments disproportionately spying on, monitoring, and then using the fruits of that surveillance to harass and arrest Black and Latino people at rates that far surpass how white people are monitored by police. So, you know, even if mugshot databases and racist algorithms aren't a part of the equation, we know that these technologies are going to be disproportionately wielded against Black and brown people, against immigrants, against poor people generally, and against dissidents. And so for that reason, the technology is going to be used in a racist manner, just as we've seen social media surveillance technology disproportionately used to target people of color, but just as we've seen surveillance cameras disproportionately placed in Black and brown neighborhoods and low-income neighborhoods. And so there's a real danger here that if we allow it, this technology is going to supercharge that racist abuse that the state has been dishing out to Black and brown people, frankly, for centuries in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very important. And I was thinking about the next point that I wanted to talk with you about, which I thought was really important and is rarely raised, I think, the surveillance Black people face and how it has a pernicious, largely unaddressed history. And I found that really important in terms of understanding the reality that Black people are up against in the world today. You cite, for instance, Lantern Laws And I don't think that's something that many people are living today actually understand what it was and what was so terrible about this, and what does it mean for what's going on today?
Yeah, so there's a scholar named Simone Brown who's done a lot of really important work looking at the, frankly, anti-Black roots of a lot of surveillance practices in the United States. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately as the abolition movement grows its power in the United States about the roots of policing and slave patrols. Well, a lot of the roots of surveillance practices come from the slavery era as well. So Simone Brown, the scholar who wrote a really fantastic book about the surveillance of Black people in the United States, observes that in New York City in the 18th century, there was a law passed these laws are referred to as lantern laws. And this was a law that required all indigenous and Black and mixed race people to carry a lantern to light their face anytime they were walking around after dark. And obviously the reason for this was so that white people could see them. So that was obviously an 18th century form of surveillance. They didn't have, you know, surveillance cameras or face surveillance technologies back then. But that is an important backstory to what we are seeing now throughout this country. Another example that Christian Parenti writes about in his important book about the history of surveillance in the United States is the origin of biometrics, a crude biometric. So a biometric just means something that's unique to every person. So faces are biometrics, the shape of our ear is a biometric. Our iris pattern is a biometric, and law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, are now collecting huge databases of people's biometric data connected to our names and addresses and other personal information so that they can control us, essentially. But the roots of this, too, come from the slavery era. So one of the first forms of biometrics in the United States was the slave pass. This was a document that white slavers would write describing the physical characteristics of enslaved people that they controlled, you know, allowing them, authorizing them to travel. You know, if a slaver wanted to send someone from his plantation to a neighboring plantation to pick something up and bring it back, he would write on a piece of paper, "My slave so-and-so has, you know, a scar above his left ear. He's about 5 feet tall. He weighs about 120 pounds. You know, he has a club foot," whatever it was, a physical description of a person. And that was done to ensure control over those human beings, to ensure that the carrier of the pass was the person who was authorized by the slaver to hold it. Because, you know, people who were enslaved were very creative and always coming up with ways to evade their controlling masters, and would, prior to these biometric slave passes, you know, pass them around and say, "Well, you can take this and travel to the next town. You know, it was given to me by the guy who, quote unquote, owns me, but why don't you take it?" So, you know, the evolution of biometric surveillance actually dates back to that period when these slavers realized, well, it's not good enough just to write so-and-so's name can go to so-and-so place on this date. We actually have to physically describe that person. I think that's a really important piece of the history here.
Yeah, I agree. And one final question I think that I want to ask you, and this flows right from what you're saying. You know, you've said that the white supremacist anti-Black history of surveillance and tracking in the U.S. persists into the present, and that's clearly obvious. There's an assault on Black Lives Matter as a reality here. I want you to talk about something you bring up in that, and you talk about how it's manifested today. And for example, the FBI surveillance programs aimed at Black identity extremists, all these kinds of things, the war on drugs and gangs. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so there are really two ways that the government, and this is the federal government as well as state and local governments, have over the past 50 or so years justified their anti-Black surveillance practices. The first is by classifying Black activism, Black liberation fights, as domestic terrorism. And this, of course, dates back to at least J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO operations in the 1950s and 60s. You know, J. Edgar Hoover, as documented in a really fantastic book called The Burglary, instructed his agents to create files on and get informed to report on not merely all black activists, but every single black college student in the country. He wanted his agents to keep track of their associations and political activities. This dates back to J. Edgar Hoover saying that the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program was a threat to national security. Of course, that free breakfast program later became a government program that now provides free breakfast to low-income children across the United States. So, you know, the federal government and state and local governments have long classified black activism, black dissent as domestic terrorism, as extremism, and we can see that today. The FBI, it was recently disclosed, I believe it was last year, has a program targeting so-called black identity extremists. These are Black Lives Matter organizers. These are people who are fighting for black liberation. And that's how the FBI justifies its surveillance and maybe even infiltration of those movements. The other primary way that we see this is through the war on drugs and the government's so-called war on gangs. It is probably not a mystery to most of your listeners that, as I said earlier, black and brown people are overwhelmingly targeted in the war on drugs. Here in the city of Boston, where I live, this is very similar to what happens nationwide. The Boston Police Department's stop and frisk data was just released. 70% of people in that database in the past year are black. That is despite the fact that the city of Boston's black population is only 24% of the people who live in the city. So wildly disproportionate rates of street-level surveillance targeting black people. And the police justify that by saying that they're the criminals. They're the dangerous gang members. They're the drug dealers. They're the gangbangers. We also see this at the federal level. The Drug Enforcement Administration, its record is wildly racist. In 2009, there was an audit of the DEA's federal drug arrests. 72%, I believe it was, of people arrested by the DEA, this 2009 review showed, were either black or Latino. That is despite the fact that black and Latino people make up less than 30% of the federal population. So, you know, whether it's through the war on black activism or through the war on drugs, the government is justifying its surveillance and targeting of black and brown people, you know, by invoking either domestic terrorism or this sort of shrug, whatever, you know, they're dangerous, they're bad, they're the people who are harming our communities. And we know for a fact that white people and people of color use and sell drugs at the same rates across this country. So it is simply not the case that black and brown people are uniquely criminal or are, you know, more involved with drug sales or drug use than their white neighbors. It is absolutely the case that black and brown people are nonetheless targeted at wildly disproportionate rates compared to white people.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Cade Crockford, director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Technology for Liberty Project, about face recognition surveillance technology and how it's used against black people and others.
Yeah, and one mistake in all this, you make this point, I think it really stuck with me. One mistake in all of this can bring on terrible consequences, including death by cop, regularly.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I have nightmares, waking nightmares about what would happen, for example. You know, we're going to start to see, as we're seeing in China and some other countries, police departments adopting technology that integrates artificial intelligence into glasses, right? Or even contact lenses in the future, so that a police officer walking down the street is scanning every face of people who pass him by, and every person, you know, automatically in the cop's field of vision, it pops up that person's name, their, you know, criminal record, how many arrests they have, whether the police think that they're dangerous or not. And we can see exactly what's going to happen if we allow that to occur. You know, mistakes will be made, even if mistakes are not made. You know, the fact that people of color are more likely to have lengthy criminal records because of the history of racist policing in the United States, it's going to result in interactions between police and black and brown people that otherwise probably wouldn't happen. You know, a cop seeing someone, oh, this guy's got a criminal record, let me stop him, right? Oh, you know, this man made a furtive movement, maybe tugged on his pants. I thought he was reaching for a weapon, so I feared for my life and I killed him, Your Honor. That combined with the toxic Supreme Court precedent around qualified immunity, which gives, frankly, license to kill to police officers all across this country, is going to result in tragic consequences. So, you know, the ACLU and our partners are hard at work ensuring that that future does not come to pass. We are working to ban the municipal government's use of face surveillance technology in many cities around the country. We've already succeeded in 5 municipalities in Massachusetts. In the coming weeks, the city of Boston's city council is going to be voting on a measure to ban face surveillance. We expect that to succeed, and we are very happy about that because Boston will be the largest city east of San Francisco to take this step. But we're not going to give up. This is a movement that is growing. There are clear majorities of people in this country who do not believe it's appropriate for the government to be using this racially, mentally authoritarian technology. And so, you know, I think things are definitely at a breaking point in this country. And it is appalling that it took the murder of George Floyd to get everybody's attention. But here we are, and we are not going to stop until we ensure that the future does not involve police department use of technologies like this.
Now, that's a fight that I've been involved in for most of my life, and I'm really glad to hear that other people are doing this, and we need to stay in touch as it goes along. We just talked about, I guess it was about 5 or 6 months ago, but I really want to follow what you're doing with this because it's extremely important now, especially when you're talking about a fascist regime in this country, and you're looking at that, and you're looking at, we know the history of fascism, we know how the slaughter of people because of their nationality, because of the way they look, because of whatever, you know, can come down so easily, and we're facing something terrible today, and I want to make sure that people get a steady sense of what's happening and what they need to do about it. So stick around, all right?
Fantastic. Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Cade. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Cade Crockford, director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Technology for Liberty Project, about face recognition surveillance technology and how it's used against Black people and others. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today and each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Hell You Talking About by Janelle Monae. Talk to you again next week.
Sean Bell, say his name. Sean Bell, won't you say his name? Say his name. Say Say his name. Won't you say his name?
Say his name. I'm a Dallas Yard, say his name. I'm a Dude Yala, say his name.